not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and we appreciate you taking an hour out of your day-to-day to join us with Midrats. And if you're with us live, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room, where you can weigh in with the usual suspects during the course of the show. If you have an observation you'd like to share, or better yet, if there's a question that you would like for us to address to our guest in the course of the show, please put it in there. We'll add it to our list, and hopefully we'll be able to get to it before we're all said and done. And if you have to leave halfway through the show because you need to update your brackets or for any purpose that you may have to, remember you can always catch up on things that you missed or find previous episodes over at the full archive at Blog Talk Radio, or just take the shortcut and head on over to iTunes and subscribe to the free podcast. But enough of the pre-show stuff. Let's go ahead and dive into the subject for today. What we want to look at is when we look at the naval professional, besides being able to take charge and carry out the plan of the day and to have his tactical expertise taking care of his sailors, what are some other responsibilities, specifically in the intellectual realm, that he should fully understand comes with the job? I mean, that's a question for the naval professional as an individual. And arguably, even more importantly, I think that is a question that the U.S. Navy, the Coast Guard, the Marine Corps, and really all services need to hoist on board and look at as an institution. And part of that, being able to evaluate of where you are and perhaps where you need to go, is looking back at the historical development professionally of the maritime professional. You know, what is just his narrow expertise and what needs to be in the wider canon of his understanding of what he needs to do. And our guest to discuss this and more for the full hour is going to be Will Beasley Jr. He is an associate attorney with Phelps Dunbar LLP in Mississippi. He was a Phi Beta Kappa graduate from the University of Mississippi with a BA and an MA in history, where his graduate thesis explained the impact of popular culture, inter-service rivalry, civil-military relationships, strategic planning, and also the defense unification on the revolt of the admirals in 1949. He also received his JD from the University of Mississippi School of Law, where he served on the editorial board of the Mississippi Law Journal. And prior to joining Phelps Dunbar, Will worked as a research consultant with the Potomac Institute in Arlington, Virginia. He's a member of the Center for International Maritime Security, and his work on maritime history and security has appeared in Proceedings, The Strategy Bridge, and also over at USNI Blog. Will, real happy to have you on board. Welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having me on, guys. It's really an honor, and I appreciate the invite.
And I would encourage everybody, if they haven't read already, and if you follow Eagle One and myself on Twitter, on Facebook, I know you've seen the links, but if not, just go ahead and Google the title for your latest work that you put out. People can find over at the Medium is Rise and Fall of the U.S. Naval U.S. Naval Professionalism, excuse me. And what I wanted to kind of open the show with is the subtitle to your article, because I find it an interesting topic to delve into. And the subtitle is Perspectives from a Civilian Navalist. And, you know, one of the recurring topics we've had on the show is getting a lot of the thinkers on both strategy and policy going forward. And many times people think that you need to be wearing or have worn the uniform to do that, but that's not true, not in our nation or others. And there are a lot of civilian out there, civilian navalists, who have a lot to contribute to the conversation. And kind of using that as a touchstone, you know, as a civilian and somebody who has, obviously you've studied history and the naval history, what brought you towards studying the maritime side of the house, and what are some of the contributions civilian navalists like yourself can make to the progress going forward?
Well, I guess my interest in the Navy, I guess, sort of dates back to my college experience. Growing up, I was always interested in ships and those maritime sorts of things. But in college, I was involved in sort of a typical freshman, not doing a lot of reading, just sort of living sort of a typical freshman life. And during that period, I experienced an injury in a diving accident, which really sort of limited my ability to partake in physical activity. So coming out of that experience, I was really looking at sort of a way to sort of put my life together and not sort of give up. And I really sort of got involved in doing a lot of reading. And in that period of time, I returned to college. And luckily at the time, two courses being offered at the University of Mississippi History Department were two classes on World War II. There was a just sort of a general survey class on World War II, and then there was also a seminar where you were required to write a research paper. And I was always interested, as I've said, in military history, and when I was searching for a topic for this research paper, my grandfather served as naval aviator in World War II, so I decided to focus my paper on aircraft carrier tactics. And as I was doing my research and doing the reading list for the class, my advisor for the research paper sort of exposed me, I guess, to one of the, I guess, the major influence, really two major influences on me were two books, one by Clark Reynolds called History in the Sea, Essays on Maritime Strategy, which sort of lays out sort of the principles of sea power in a very concise way, and really sort of opened, you know, my eyes to maritime side of national security. And the second book that really had a profound effect on me, which was my professors were lucky enough, or at least I was lucky enough to be assigned, was the memoir With the Old Breed, Tolu in Okinawa by Eugene Sledge. And my professor who was teaching the class was a friend of Sledge and was lucky enough to assign it. And after reading that book, I just felt that it was sort of a duty for me to sort of understand the military, and especially taking into account the stuff that I had read on sea power, the maritime side of national security. So I guess I sort of fell in love with it and became a member of the Naval Institute and have been doing it ever since.
When you wrote about this piece on the rise and fall of naval professionalism, you draw a comparison to other professions. Could you kind of walk us through differences between what you perceive to be the naval profession and the similarities to, like, the legal profession or the medical profession, if you will?
Well, sure. I guess in order to answer that, I sort of need to back up a little bit and discuss, how that piece got started. It originally, the Strategy Bridge sort of ran a series on professionalism that wanted to look back at Samuel Huntington's Bulger in the State and sort of the state of military professionalism. And they sort of based it around three questions that were raised by a Dr. Pauline Shanks Karin, I believe. I hope I'm getting that name right. And the questions were, number one, is the military a profession? Number two, what does that mean for you? And number three, what are the ethical responsibilities of military members, if any? And Tyrell Mayfield, who I was lucky enough to meet on Twitter and become a follower of, someone who I don't know the real name, but the Twitter handle is Classless Rocks, was also an attorney and wrote really what I thought was just a fabulous essay on sort of comparing the military side of his law. He's a lawyer and he's also in the reserves. And sort of compared his legal career towards his military side of thinking, and I thought it was great. But Mayfield sort of asked his attorney followers for comment, and he specifically tagged me on there, so I sort of thought I required sort of a response, and. I thought it was great. I had a couple of problems with it, but he invited me to submit a piece for the series. And I initially sort of objected I'm a civilian. I don't have any, experience in military professionalism. And, I had a couple of military followers who explained the holes in my reasoning here. Some may be in the chat room below. I don't know if they're tuned in or not. But really encouraged me to submit my thoughts as a civilian. And in answering the question, I thought that I'd recently read a book on the development of naval professionalism by the famous historian Ronald Spector. And he really turned to sort of what was going on in the 1880s and 1890s, and what I refer to in my article to as sort of the golden age of professionalism. And this is when we see a lot of careers sort of developing around, I guess, sort of a better way to put it, is many of the modern professions that we know today, for instance, doctors, lawyers, and social workers, and those sorts of things, really develop along. It's really a process of number one, being engaged in a full-time work that deals with a specific set of problems, deals with education and has a training process, develops a professional association, receives public and legal recognition, and also forms a body of ethics. And during this time, I think the Navy has already succeeded in a number of these goals. Number one, they certainly have legal recognition because it's, you know, right there in the Constitution. Number one, they're certainly naval professionals. They're certainly engaged in the full-time body of work and are working on a specific set of problems. At the time, during the golden age of professionalism, which I would call roughly 1880 to 1890, they're well on their way to developing a system of training because the Naval Academy has been going on, was founded in 1845. The Naval Institute is also up and running. So they arguably have a professional association in place. But one of the things, at least in my opinion, and I think in Spector's opinion too, that the Navy is really missing is a specialized theoretical body of knowledge specific to the naval profession. And they're also missing public recognition as a service. I mean, they're certainly recognized in the Constitution, but among the public, they hold a relatively low status.
What do you think is the cause of that relatively low status? Is it an outreach issue? Is it a perception issue? Or is it actually related to something that the public is seeing that perhaps inside the lifelines people don't appreciate?
Well, I think there at the time, certainly, there are a number of problems that are going on that are preventing or is preventing the Navy from achieving public recognition. And I guess sort of the overall problem is that the officer corps during this period, the Civil War is over, but there's really a civil war going on within the officer corps itself. And this relates to several problems that I think are very interrelated, some of which apply to all navies, and some of which are specific to the United States Navy. And I guess to run through the list, really, one of the first problems is the state of technological innovation that's going on during the period. And this is really a macro problem affecting all navies of the time. I guess to start off, you have to go back to the age of sail. And whenever you want to start that period, I know historians disagree on, you know, when exactly that age began. But throughout that period, which is roughly, you know, 100, 150 years, if not more, technology advances very, 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 very slowly. Constitution, for instance, is built in 1790, acting very effectively in 1840. There are certainly advances in naval architecture, which allows you to put more guns on a ship, and there's certainly developments in architecture like you've got copper bottoming that allows ships to move much more swiftly. But this is really a slow technical process. And beginning in the 1830s and 40s, the technological change becomes much more rapid. And the officers that are brought up during the age of sail are really sort of taken aback by this. They're used to, you know, a sound, you know, doctrinal system where you put the ships together at pistol shot and have at it. And whoever fires the guns the fastest usually has the most success. But sort of running through, I guess, the major developments, number one is the development of steam propulsion, which really has a profound effect on the profession. It enables gives the ship an amazing amount of tactical freedom. You're no longer, you know, harnessed to the wind, and speeds are much more rapid. You know, during the age of sail, if you're relying on the wind, you're basically traveling, you know, roughly, I guess the average speed is 12 knots on a good windy day. But under a steam-powered screw, you know, you're turning it up to, you know, 20 knots. Another advance is, of course, iron and later steel replaces the wooden hull, which provides really two things. Number one is protection from the gunnery that's advancing very rapidly along the same lines. And iron and steel-plated ships, you're able to build much larger vessels. And I sort of spoke about gunnery before, which is also developing along the same lines. And you start out, you know, with smoothbore barrels, which are just, you know, extremely inaccurate, developing into breech-loaded rifle barrels, which increases the range tremendously and also increases the power of the shell. And just, I guess sort of just to give, you know, sort of a rough comparison point would be a ship, I'm fast-forwarding a little bit, but shell fired in 1905, one shell throws roughly the equivalent weight of an entire broadside from HMS Victory, which is really a tremendous advance. And in order to protect themselves from this new gunnery, you know, armor has to run a race to keep up with the power of ordnance. And you also have the self-propelled torpedo, which is introduced at the time and really revolutionizes what you can do with the flotilla, which is, you know, Corbett's term, but would certainly apply to any sort of small vessel, anything that can get a torpedo in the water and aim it correctly and get lucky enough to hit a capital ship can take the whole thing down. And there's also developments in we always tend to forget about the ram, which is sort of the, I guess, the red-headed stepchild of all these developments that turns out to be not so great development and it was roughly discarded. But these technical changes and really the rapidity of the changes, they really lead to three other problems. The first being expense. Change is occurring so rapidly through all the, based on the, you know, the things that I've mentioned, that a ship, its effectiveness for the class of one vessel, it's roughly irrelevant. I mean, instead of measuring the effectiveness of a class in decades, you're really starting to look at limiting it to years based on the rapidity of change. And this really creates a tremendous expense for navies at the time to keep up with the latest weapons in order to be able to, you know, have a fleet that's relatively effective. And the second thing that this leads to is extreme intimidation in the officer corps. Sort of, I guess I've already related to this, but during the age of sail, you know, this relatively slow rate of change is replaced by a very complex system based on steam navigation, electricity, armor, torpedoes, and long-range gunnery, and it really throws the officer corps aback. And, I mean, I guess in order to figure out how to implement all this stuff together, there's a Royal Navy, I think he's an admiral at the time, Edmund Freemantle, who says, you know, tactics on the arm, or I'm sorry, on with iron, we're really groping around in the dark to try to figure out how to use all this stuff. And sort of, I guess, the third change is with all of this development in technology, the engineer is really pushing for much more influence. People, I guess, kind of forget that at the time, at least in the U.S. Navy, that staff officers, which consist of engineers, surgeons, naval contractors, and paymasters, are really identified by function instead of rank. They don't hold the rank of lieutenant, lieutenant commander, captain. They hold basically their titles of assistant engineer, head engineer, that sort of thing. But with the advances in engineering that's being made, they really sort of say, look here, guys, I mean, you guys don't know what you're doing when it comes to all of this technology, and we really do. And they really start pushing for much more influence. And, you know, when you have a sort of power relationship with one group pushing for more influence, you're certainly going to have the other side, which is the line officers, who are really going to be pushing back. And they really do. And they're the ones in power. And they try to, or really do succeed in really trying to limit the number of engineers and their possibility for advancement in the American Navy.
Well, let me jump in for a second, because I think that gets to a point of professionalism, and that back in the 19th century, let me run from there. You know, people stayed on active duty for a lot longer than they do now, and as Mahan and those guys came along, they had spent already a substantial amount of their life as naval officers and developed a lot of the professional schools and all that. Nowadays, it seems like the average effective naval life of a naval officer is really pretty short. I mean, we're looking at people who are in for, if you're a professional, in for 20 to 30 years, and if you make admiral, maybe a little longer than that, and you may retire before you're 60, whereas some of these, back in the 18th century, I'm not even sure they had a mandatory retirement age, and people got promoted when somebody else died. Is that one of the reasons, do you think, that we see to a certain extent a decline in naval professionals now, as people are aware of how short a time they have to do all the things to develop the, as I think Sal said earlier, the tactical and technical skills to get to a certain point, and they don't have the time to look on to the other professional aspects of strategy and all those other highfalutin things?
Well, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, considering the history on this, I would probably have to agree with that comment. When you sort of look at what's happening in the Navy during this period, and you sort of have to look at, I think, all of the sort of schools that you alluded to that are being created, Naval War College being the main one, and all these developments in technology, goes back to the promotion system at the time, which was based, you know, purely linear. You didn't move up until someone either retired or was promoted or had committed a felony. And it has to be a pretty bad felony in order to get kicked out. And this is sort of, there are good things about this, and there are bad things about this. One of the good things is that you're guaranteed employment. And the United States experiences a recession in the 1870s, so there's sort of an incentive to stay in with, you know, you get a steady paycheck. But bad things, and there's certainly, I believe, more bad things than good about this, is that at the state of the time, after the Civil War, the Navy, which existed at the end of the Civil War, was over 600 ships. But its congressional policy at the time to basically sell off all those vessels. They, number one, they want to return to sail. And they want to keep a number of ironclads around for coastal defense. And there really aren't that many opportunities for officers to get experience. So promotion is very, very, very slow. And another, I guess, one of the causes of this is because of the linear system that's going on at the time. During the Civil War, you have this huge influx of recruits that join up and, you know, want to be a part of the naval profession. And during the war, promotion is very, very rapid. But after the war is over and Congress changes policy and decides we need a much smaller fleet, there's this huge backlog of what I call in my paper, it's basically a lieutenant logjam, and promotion is just very, very slow. And at the time, there is a mandatory retirement age at 62. And if you're lucky enough to still be in the Navy, and if you're lucky enough to advance and reach flag rank at that time, because you've got to retire at 62, you're lucky if you're an admiral for 1 or 2 years. But this lieutenant logjam really sort of leads to sort of a lot of the reforms that's going on, because a lot of the reforms come from below, from the younger officers who are sort of fed up and sort of going through life, going through duty. They're held in very low regard with the public, and they want to change that. And there are only a couple of things you can do if you're in this situation. You can either give up and resign, and if you've got a connection, you've got like the research on this really shows that if you've got a connection outside with like a banker or a merchant or an attorney, and you've got an in, you do retire. Or you can try to make yourself as useful as possible and really, you know, concentrate on a specific area of all these technological problems that the Navy has to deal with.
In the
fight and make your discontent known.
You bring up in the core of your article, you know, right here in the middle of the Gilded Age, from the 1870s up to the 1900s. I mean, you had that group in that pack of the long endurance lieutenants that right at that inflection point of the shift from sail to steam. There was a group of folks you describe and others have as the Young Turks. You had Chambers and Fisk and Sims and Luce. talk about their synergy and how they helped an intellectual pivot take place right there in the middle of the golden age as we move to the top of the new century.
Sure. First, I guess I need to point out that the Young Turks is a label used by historians. The guys at the time didn't call themselves Young Turks. That term comes from a group of younger professionals in Turkey who actually advocate for constitutional reform, and they are known as the Young Turks. So this is how this term sort of comes about. And if you are a reformer, you basically are able, I think, this argument is really made by Peter Carson in his great book on the naval aristocracy, that you're able to call yourself a Young Turk. And really, I guess the thing that really sparks off the Young Turks are, in order to deal with this lieutenant logjam that's going on at the time, Congress passes this law in 1882, which limits the number of officers from ensigns and above. Just to sort of give you an idea, I'll give you the numbers. It's 75 ensigns, 75 lieutenant JGs, 250 lieutenants, 74 lieutenant commanders, 86 commanders, 45 captains, 10 commodores, 6 rear admirals, 1 vice admiral, and 1 admiral. And with the creation of this system, it becomes even more difficult to advance because it really requires, in order for a JO to get promoted, it really requires the retirement or the promotion of 2 senior officers. And if you're in the academy at the time, you really have to be at the top 25% of your class to have any hope of getting a promotion. For instance, the class that enters the academy in 1881, only 7% received commissions. And this is when they sort of say, look, we've had enough of this. It's time to fight, and we're going to change this. And this is where you get the Young Turks. And there's been a lot of research on the factors of the Young Turk and, you know, where they came from and what sort of people they are. And really sort of, the only real evidence or real only really identifying factor is that they're all very, very smart. 40% who you would classify as the Young Turks graduated the top 10% of their class. And in order to institute change and really push, get a lot of pushback against this law, they try a number of things. The first thing that they do is they hire lobbying firms to form pressure groups to repeal the law. And a lot of them also file suit in court. That's pretty unsuccessful. But they do have a relatively little bit of success with the lobbying firms. But I guess sort of a different tactic that they take, they turn to PR, and they turn to Sea Power PR in order to let the nation know that the U.S. Navy is critical to national security for business reasons. And they take this argument to the public, and they begin to publish And they really publish these pieces sort of targeted at several, or really three main groups. One is, of course, weapons manufacturers and shipbuilders. The second is merchant marine businessmen. And the third is the American public. And sort of another, I guess, factor that's going on during the this historical period of time that sort of allows them to do this is the printing business is really booming. There's all sorts of magazines and places where you can write, almost sort of like today with the internet. If you really want to write something to get it out there, you can pretty much find somebody that's going to be able to do it. A lot of their articles are published in Proceedings, but a lot of them are published elsewhere, or they're picked up by bigger publications from Proceedings. And really one of the leaders here, who's I guess is really the most famous of the Sea Power advocates, is Washington Irving Chambers. You know, he becomes later known as sort of the father of naval aviation, but he's sort of one of the main ones that I would call a Sea Power advocate. But there are numerous others arguing that America should turn outward to increase global investment, and that was really the destiny of the nation. Now, you've got a couple of other guys. I mentioned Bradley Fisk and William Sims. Really, at this time, they're sort of two examples that really turn inward and really begin to focus on specific problems within the Navy that need to be solved. Fisk begins to focus his career on electricity, and he invents a rangefinder, and he will eventually become, or eventually will be, one of the fathers of the torpedo plane. Whereas William Sims, you know, turns to gunnery and becomes sort of a gun doctor, I guess you would call him. If you want to learn about William Sims, you can listen to one of your previous episodes with one of your previous guests, or you could turn and get on the internet and buy 21st Century Sims and learn a whole lot about him.
You know, one of the advantages that the Navy had, some of these thinkers that we had back in the late 1890s, was that Teddy Roosevelt was either Assistant Secretary of the Navy because they wanted to get him out of New York where he was doing too good a job as police commissioner, or he was, and you know, he's a naval historian, he'd written that book on the War of 1812. Is that a matter of luck? Did that help increase the professionalism of the people then? And to add even more, one more question, is there a hope that we will get some kind of navalist president or other figure in our government that would give similar strength and courage to some of our naval professionals?
I certainly hope so, to take the last question first. But I guess sort of getting back to your first part with the, you know, sort of Teddy Roosevelt's influence on professional development really is going to come back to Stephen Luce and his development of the Naval War College. Luce is lucky enough to meet his father early on while Teddy Roosevelt is at Harvard when he's writing his book on the War of 1812. And he's introduced to him. And when Luce finally gets the Naval War College going, he invites him to lecture on the War of 1812 there. and really the history of the Naval War College in its early years is really a struggle for survival. It gets a lot of pushback from the bureau chiefs, and especially the superintendent of the Naval Academy, who, you know, really don't want a second, you know, naval school there because they think it's going to, you know, take away from their influence. And sort of as, you know, we advance through president, once an administration comes in that, you know, is opposed to the college, Lewis is writing Roosevelt and, you know, asking, you know, what can we do? What sort of the status of things, you know, who can I talk to? Put me in contact with the right person. Do we need to write an article? Those sorts of things. So Roosevelt is extremely influential, I think, in sort of not necessarily the founding of the Naval War College, but really keeping it going during its early years.
Let's kind of pull the thread on that when you look at period of times and the organization as it grew. If you could, let's kind of look at three periods. You know, what did Luce do at the beginning to get things set up? And then we had our friend Sims come on board and kind of shifted the focus. And then, you know, let's look at what Sims did and what Sims helped develop. And then let's move this forward to the post-World War II era. And what are your views on what became of the War College in the post-World War II era, and how does that impact the education today?
Well, I guess to start with Luce, you sort of have to start at the end of his life. And the best description, I think, that you can give about Luce was written by one of his young Turks, Bradley Fisk, in the Proceedings issue of 1917. He writes an obituary on Luce, and I'm just going to read it. Quote, "Luce taught the Navy to think about the Navy as a whole. More clearly than any other man in American history, he saw the relations that ought to exist between central government and its military and its naval officers. He saw strategy as clearly as most of us see a material object. To him, more than any other officer who ever lived, are naval officers of every nation indebted for the understanding they have of their profession." And he's the father of naval education. And to sort of get at the founding of the college, it's sort of a bit unclear on sort of when he came up with his theories. And his theories are really based on what I call in the article the comparative history and scientific study of war. And he really claims that he came up with this during his Civil War days. And when he's having this, he has a conversation with General Sherman during the Charleston campaign. And he writes about this later in a Proceedings article. And he writes as follows, and this is Sherman speaking here, "You Navy fellows have been hammering away at Charleston for 3 years, but just wait until I get into South Carolina. I will cut our communications, and Charleston will fall into your hands like a ripe pear." And Luce responds, "After hearing General Sherman's clear exposition of the situation, the scales seemed to fall from my eyes. it dawned upon me that there were certain fundamental principles underlying military operations, principles in general application, where the operations were conducted, whether operations are conducted on land or at sea. And since he believed that there were certain principles of strategy that were permanent, he argued these principles could eventually be taught and studied, but had to be discovered through the study of history and past naval and military campaigns under similar conditions to distill the lessons and the lessons learned. And he really sort of founds the college upon this idea. He starts the college. It's not, you know, he brings Mahan on, but to give lectures, but it's really not based on a lecture format. You're not spoon-fed. It's kind of like graduate school today. You're not spoon-fed, what you learn. You only learn what you put into it. You're there to undertake research, and what you put into it is what you're going to get out of it. And the curriculum, you know, under Luce is really sort of one of the main problems that they face is they have very, very, very few people that are actually assigned to take the class. And they're also very, very, very short. But as the college moves along, they're finally able to get a one-year class, and the program really begins to take shape, I guess sort of in the golden years, during Sims' time, and you really have a much more structured program with assigned reading, which would really hold up well today. And you're studying a number of subjects. You're studying history, you're studying area studies, a number of subjects. And you're also required to write a book report on your readings. You're also required to write a thesis. And one of the main, I think, contributions that Sims makes during his time is wargaming. And he really sort of emphasizes this way as a way for officers to sort of begin to think about command and begin to learn on their haven't ever experienced battle before. And he wants to give them a chance to sort of learn sort of how to do this and create sort of the best environment that they can. But after the war, you've got a bunch of officers who would be assigned to the college who have already been through a war. And they think that they're not, you know, why do I need to go to the war college? I know what I'm doing. I've been through it. I've done it. And that's when you really, really see a fall off in the war college, and people sort of see it sort of a vacation hangout instead of a place for serious study of history, of military history, of cultural studies, and a place to become exposed to serious reading lists that will create an interest, and you'll be able to study really for the rest of your life. And it's only through, Sims really emphasizes this, it's only through, you know, intense education and, you know, systematic study of naval history, of military history, of cultural studies, it's only then that you're going to be able to call yourself a professional, because someone who only understands operations, president of the United States, and I'm asking you for your advice, and all you can tell me about are military operations and operational theory, and you can't tell me anything about the environment in which I'm going to fight, you are doing me no good at all.
Well, that raises one of those great questions about where we're going with the training of our younger officers now. I think Sal has hit on this a number of times, and I'm certainly familiar with it. But I think for the ROTC students now around the country, that 80% have to have technical degrees or degrees in, you know, things like biology, other true sciences instead of, you know, sociology or psychology or God forbid, a degree in history. Is that, you know, that then we point to our nuke buddies as being responsible for some of this. Is that a bad thing? Should we have more in our junior officers, more liberal arts background in studies of history and anthropology and other subjects like that?
When I first learned about that limitation, the 85% limitation on ROTC students, I was floored. I really couldn't believe it. I sort of sent an email to one of my, Navy friends who was pretty high up in the training organization and asked him about it. And of course his response is, well, you know, the Navy is a technical service. It's the most technical service. You require, that's why we need engineers. But you're really giving up something that's very, very valuable. And this sort of brings us full circle to Luz. During his early days, when he's assigned his first assignment to the USS Congress, he is given a number of books, and we can read about this. He's sailing around the world in his journal. He's reading history. He's reading literature. He's reading Dickens, Shakespeare. And he's basically providing himself with a liberal arts education. And he really argues that these are the kinds of subjects that you need to know about in order to handle men sympathetically. And without those subjects, I think we're doing, and without requiring them, or at least lowering the percentage, we're really doing ourselves a great and really dangerous disservice.
Well, on that note, we got about a minute left, Will. And again, I recommend everybody, if you haven't already, make sure and look up Will's article where he fleshes out a lot of the issues we brought up today. You just need to Google Rise and Fall of U.S. Naval Professionalism. I think it's a good follow-up piece to your 2014 piece in Proceedings, Answering Mayday. Besides your paying gig that you need to keep a focus on the naval side of the house, what are some things you've been thinking about that we could look forward to reading from you?
Well, I've got one article. This is one of the main, the actual reason that I protested doing a piece for the strategy grid is I just finished an article and submitted it on the need for a balanced Navy. And that's currently under review by Proceedings. And it sort of takes the view that we've really doing ourselves a disservice by not having a flotilla, and that's being exploited, I believe, or I argue, by the Chinese in the South Pacific. or no, I'm sorry, not the South Pacific, but the South China Sea. That's one thing that is already finished. And I've got another article sort of in the works that is really just kind of rattling around in my brain at this point on the connection between the need for navies and their economic impact on the nation, and really looking at history in a broader context to sort of illustrate that lesson. But that's really just kind of rolling around in my head at this point, and I'm sort of just getting started on it. So who knows when that'll see pen to paper. So.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing it. And thanks again, Will, for taking an hour of out of your Sunday to spend with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, guys. It's really been an honor.
Well, thank you for taking the time, as Will, as Sal said.
And thank you, everybody, who are joining us here for another edition of MidRats. And please join us next week. And until then, hope you all have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell.